This has come to be in my notes anyway. SSBA. So I was right at the top of my page. Speeches and Sermons, Book of Acts. And that's what we've been studying. This is now the sixth lesson. And since we're talking about speeches and sermons, of course, we're skipping past, say, the narrative, the action part of the story, and we're looking at it, the speeches and sermons, as speeches and sermons. And so that's a different way of maybe studying the Bible than we're used to. In this case, we look at the speaker. Who is speaking? Why is this person speaking rather than someone else? What kind of person are they? And why do they find themselves in this forum? Look at the audience. Who is gathered? They haven't just gathered at random, but a very specific group of people is gathered in that place. And we also then look at the setting and we try to interpret the tone of the gathering. And so we've looked at some really interesting little episodes. First off, we started with Peter and the replacement for Judas at the very beginning of the book of Acts. And then we went to the speech at Pentecost, which is more familiar to people, or they've maybe thought about it a little bit more. Let's see, what else did we go for then? We looked at Peter speaking to a spontaneous gathering, a mob that had gathered around a healing and how he addressed them. And then we jumped from such an informal setting to an extremely formal setting when we had Stephen defending himself before the Sanhedrin. You could almost not think of more opposite settings and situations to be in as a public speaker, can you? You know, on one hand, you have to speak extemporaneously to a crowd that's gathered around a healing outside the temple, and it would be a real mixed crowd, and the other one is a very formal setting in which you would have time to prepare, and so we looked at those sermons too. And we jumped from there to see another interesting one at the Jewish Pentecost. Peter went to the house of Cornelius, and that was marked for several reasons. First off, it was the first speech we looked at that wasn't given to Jews. It was given to a Gentile audience that was, let me say, coming to Christ or in the process of being converted. And so that was very different. And we see that every time the speaker has to vary their presentation. Speaking to the Jews, of course, they start with their Jewish identity, with the law, with all the things about Jewishness. But when we saw Peter go into Cornelius' house, the first thing out of his mouth is, "I see now God shows no partiality. He accepts people from all nations." And you see he was almost maybe realizing it as he spoke. I don't know. I don't think it was necessarily a spontaneous speech. I think he probably thought about it on the way up. It was way from Joppa up to where he was going, Caesarea. Well, you saw how this goes. Well, then last week we looked at what? Well, we were on the first missionary journey, and we talked about that. The church at Antioch, which has now established a church among people from a Gentile background. Not surprisingly, God uses this church to launch the first missionary efforts around the Mediterranean world, and they send them off. And there they go, Paul and Barnabas and John Mark. Head out to Cyprus, the island in the Mediterranean, right? And then they go back over to the mainland, what would be our modern-day Turkey, and they work their way up into the part of Turkey called Anatolia, and they end up in the town of Antioch, Pisidia, and we see that Paul was speaking where in Antioch and Pisidia? In a synagogue. So this was actually our first speech in a synagogue. And so we spent some time talking about what's a synagogue like? Who's there? What's the setting? And that gets interesting because we divided the audience. Remember, we said there would be those Jews who lived in exile, or not in exile, that's a silly way to say it. They lived in diaspora. They lived out away from Jerusalem. But there were also present in the audience the God-fearers, the proselytes, those people who had gathered around a Jewish-type vision of God and wanting to worship Him. And Paul gets up to speak in that context, and he gives a fairly elaborate speech. But remember, he starts with Moses, and he talks about how the people were dwelling in a strange land. It seems like an interesting pitch for a group of Jews who are living away from Palestine. And talks from there, rehearsing Jewish history. But then we saw that the sermon once again pivoted at a really interesting place. I think it was 1326, was it? Yeah, 1326. We saw that the speech took a right turn, a sharp turn, in which he quit rehearsing Jewish history, and he talked about how Jesus was the answer, that there was salvation through forgiveness and justification. I couldn't help but think about that a lot this morning while Rob was preaching, because it was almost exactly his point, wasn't it? That a Jew would, because of their exposure to the law, have a fine-tuned sense of what God required and probably a pretty fine-tuned sense of guilt about it. And as I see it, Rob in the position of Paul at in Antioch Pisidia here, saying exactly the same thing, wasn't he? There's a point of failure there, and there needs to be another answer. And so that becomes the real, as I said, the real sharp turn in Paul's sermon in the synagogue. And he left it hanging. Verse 41, I said, it almost ends abruptly, because the end of the message is, don't miss it. Don't harden your hearts. There's forgiveness and justification available. And wow, you couldn't give that message to everybody. It assumes a certain kind of knowledge or background in the person to give that kind of speech. Now, I had great plans at that point. I was going to contrast that with a speech that he'll give just a little later, Paul, among in a Gentile gathering. And I was going to lay them out and put them side by side. And as I told you, that was a very exuberant plan. And I was basically retooling my talk as I gave it, because I thought, we're not going to get that far. By the time we'd rehearsed it and talked about everything about the setting in the synagogue and analyzed that particular message, there was no time left to get to the next one. As you know, in the book of Acts, often, as I said, you get the middle of it, and Paul starts doing his missionary voyages and things like that. The pattern has usually been to go to the Jewish audience first at the synagogue, wait till that blows up, and then go speak to the Gentiles. And often what we've seen is that who responds best? Well, a few of the Jews respond well, but a lot of the God-fearers and proselytes, that crowd of people really responds well to the message. Let's see. As we read the story of this missionary journey, we'll find that it doesn't go real well for Paul in a lot of places here. I mean, he'll be even stoned at one point, left for dead. And he's not always being received well. And we'll find that the Jewish hostility really picks up and moves from city to city and follows him around. And it always ends up in a big fiasco, really. It's a pretty remarkable thing as a missionary journey, you would think. We look back on it, and it looks kind of exciting, but I think if you were getting the dispatches back there in email at Antioch, you'd say, what on earth? Chaos seems to be erupting and haunting this whole endeavor, and you wonder how a church even arises out of some of the chaos that ensues here. Okay, well, let's look at 14. As we're bouncing around these cities, as things are going rough, could I get somebody to, let's read a couple of different things just to fill in the story here. Could somebody read chapter 13, read us verses 45, 46, and then verse 50, and we're going to try to fill in the story between the synagogue at Antioch Pisidia and where we are now. So 13, verses 45, 46, and 50. Anyone who would like to read them. Okay, we're trying to fill in what's happening in this story between the synagogue and Antioch Pisidia and where I'm going to take us today. So there we have a picture of it. How's it look to you?
Tense.
Very tense. What does this do to speakers and gatherings who come together to listen to speakers? What's that? Yeah, well, then don't people start coming already with their minds made up and they start sitting on different sides of the room and wearing buttons? I'm for Paul, you know, stone him again, harder, you know, whatever, you know, I mean, you'd wear stuff. Have you ever been in a room where a speaker spoke to an audience where it was tense like that? When Vicki and I were in Bolivia last winter, we went to a religious conference and it got real tense afterwards, and you started looking around the room to see which the fastest exit was in case, you know, in case things started flying. It was really remarkable, and oddly enough, it was some of the prominent women who were getting feisty, but you know, they usually conduct business in Spanish, but some of the women start jumping up and arguing in the Indian tongue, Quechua, and they're really scolding one another, and you're just beginning to think, like, I'm getting out of here. But it's real exciting. You have a fascination with it, and you can't tear yourself away. That's how you get caught in these mob things, you know, but you just hope it'll just calm down. I mean, I didn't think it was, you know, like my life was in danger, but I thought, this is getting ugly, and it felt ugly, but it was kind of exciting to sit there and listen to it all. Just thinking, just imagine yourself in these situations. Let's go to chapter 14, and would somebody read us verse 2? Yeah. So once again, unbelieving Jews were working on the Gentile population to reject what Paul, Barnabas were saying. Remember, John Mark flaked out and went back to Antioch over in Cyprus. Okay, so we end up in the city of Lystra. And there's not much, as I told you, the Anatolian area is apparently high windswept places, unbearably hot in the summer, unbearably cold in the winter, and passages that go through endlessly dangerous, little narrow, rocky places. Other than that, I couldn't find out a lot about the town of Lystra. It did have a temple to Zeus there, and there were a couple references in ancient literature where Zeus had apparently visited the city, and so that was their pride and joy and what put them on the map. They had a temple there for him. So, you know who Zeus is, right? We just see in your Bibles, there's Zeus and Hermes. These were the Greek gods. Zeus is the big, powerful, big cheese god of the Greek pantheon. Hermes has different roles that he plays as a messenger and a spokesperson. When these got translated, they're corresponding Greek deities and Roman deities. You know how that goes? Jupiter and... what's the name? Mercury. Yeah. You remember Mercury, right, with the... if you're old enough, remember the old Mercury dimes, the helmet with wings and the wings on the feet? You don't remember this? Yeah. Yes, thank you, Marcus. I don't think I'm making it up. Mercury used to be on the American court. You remember this, don't you?
The car was a Mercury.
Okay, good. All right.
He had that on the steering wheel.
These are the same deities. Actually, it depends. Like, the Greek New Testament text will use the Greek deities' names, but if it's got the influence of the Latin translations, it'll use the Latin versions of these. It's very interesting. The Romans and Greeks often tried to pair their gods up, but they believed him. This temple was serious business, and it was to Zeus or Jupiter. All right, enough of that stuff. Would somebody, let's set the setting for this next speech. It's in 14, 8 through 14, and we need somebody to read it. And when you get to 14, okay, yeah, I think you're fine. Yeah, just read through 14. Okay. Well, let's just pause here before we give his speech now. All right, so you've got the setting, a healing. There's not a lot really said about that, but it's dramatic for everybody, especially since this person had never walked, had been apparently crippled in this way from birth. And a speech is about to happen, but do you picture it happening right away? There's the healing, and is this like the healing at the temple where a crowd appeared to rush upon the gathering, or do you get the feeling some time has lapsed? Why?
Because they went and brought things.
Yeah. It seems like you don't just you know, grab anybody's old oxen. I mean, I think they had special oxen to do this with, and garlands take a little while, and the priests, you know, old fellow, they need to get him there and get him in on the act. So it takes a while to get these things prepared, don't you think? I don't know. I mean, it doesn't say specifically, but I just don't get the feeling there's the sense that it necessarily happens all at once. It would take some time, and it seems, though, that Paul and Barnabas might not know really what's going on. Why might that be?
When they find out, they stop it.
Well, yeah, they try to stop it.
It mentions that the people are all talking in their own local language.
Yeah, the Lyconian language. And, I mean, I get the feeling is probably there was buzz and chatter, and I'm not saying, I don't know how much time it takes to assemble the oxen garlands, get the priest there and all that stuff. I'm getting the feeling maybe Paul and Barnabas are doing other things, talking with people privately, maybe even teaching a little bit, but something's boiling in the background. They're not quite on to it, and they're not on to it because it's in a different language. Do you know, no one's ever been able to figure out that language. What it is exactly that's being referenced here. As far as we know, there is no Lyconian language, I mean, spoken about anywhere else in the ancient world. Some people suggest it was just maybe a really heavy dialect of the Greek language, but others don't know. Yeah?
So what language did Paul tell that guy to stand up in?
Probably Greek. Most people in that part of the world knew their Greek, but when people are excited, they go back to the mother tongue, right? Don't they? I mean, I think it is. I've been around enough language situations to know. I once was talking to some Hindus about Jesus, a couple of guys, and they're real funny because I could tell that they'd start with me in English and ask me a question about Jesus, and I'd answer. They wanted to meet a Christian who knew something about Hinduism, the religion of India, and they'd ask me a question, and I'd answer, and they'd start talking to one another in English, and then they'd switch to Hindi, which is kind of the big mother tongue of India. But then they went into they'd start arguing with one another, and you could tell they switched languages again when they started arguing with each other about what they thought about what I was saying. So I was watching a conversation go through three languages. You know, I hadn't a word what they were saying. I mean, you know, but I just, you could notice the shift, and they even started joking about it with me. I said, when we really disagree, we jump over to the other one, you know, and that's the one we want to argue. So they're talking in Lyconian because they're all worked up, right? And they don't know what's going on. And then we get the speech. When the apostles, Barnabas and Paul, heard this, they tore their clothes and ran in among the multitude, crying out and saying. What did we say about tearing clothes?
They didn't tear completely.
Yeah, it's a deliberate gesture, not a wild man ripping his shirt off and running into the middle of the crowd here. It's hard for us to get it. So what's it? Men, why are you doing these things? We also are men with the same nature as you, and preach to you that you should turn from these useless things to the living God who made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all that are in them, who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. Amen. That's where the speech ends, right? And with these sayings, they could scarcely refrain the multitudes from sacrificing to them. Okay. First of all, what do we say about speeches in the book of Acts in terms of their actual length versus the reported length? What's that? I'm guessing the reported version is short. It's just a divine summary of what was being said. Now, I don't know how long this went, but I'm saying such things, I'm getting the feeling there was elaboration on all of these points and that we're getting a summarized version of it. Let's set the setting here. What's the speaker up against? Let's look at 14. What's the setting? a multitude. So that says big crowd to me, right? Not a little gathering. This is a big crowd. And who all's in it? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Far from Jews, I'm saying kind of riled up, excited, positively though, charged with positive energy, right? Not negative energy. This isn't a crowd that wants to kill him. This is a crowd that wants to worship him, for heaven's sakes. So there's a sort of positive energy here. Apparently there's an oxen or so present. And he runs into the multitude. So how do you picture the setting?
Chaotic.
I picture being in the middle. That's hard to address a group when you're in the middle of it, right? With your ripped shirt. You have to address this, and the cattle are lowing. The poor babe awakes. You know, it's just this setting. He runs into the middle of it, and how do you handle a crowd like that? You're Paul. Hermes, as it were. Mercury. What's going through your mind? You're desperate, but what's your mind telling you to do about addressing this crowd, do you think? You want to calm them? How do you do that? That's the approach I took with my three sons. You know, if it got, I'm bigger, stronger, louder, and more dangerous. You know, is that going to work here? No. No, it's not going to.
He engages them. He asks the question.
Okay, that's the question. Is what? Okay, so how does he intone this? I mean, you think this is a delicate situation. It's not a negative crowd, but when he says, "Man, why are you doing these things?" How do you picture him saying this, or asking this, shall we say?
Slowly, one word at a time.
All right. And what's his expression?
Well, his gestures would be.
But you see, there's a big difference. This is a rhetorical question, right? And you can ask rhetorical questions, not like expecting an answer, right? Rhetorical questions they can be said many ways. They can feign surprise. They can express outrage. They can be angry. They can be gentle. Why are you doing these things? Is that going to work well? Or why are you doing these things? Or why are you doing these things? Or what are you doing? How do you picture it?
It says crying out.
Yeah. It has to be a big voice then, I would think.
It says he ran among them. I picture him kind of frantic. That when you're running and crying out. It's not.
With your torn shirt.
Yeah. That's not real calm.
No. I'm just fascinated what is in his mind at this point. Because I said, I don't think it's possible that you would not think about, how am I going to play this? How am I going to do this? And it is a tense and excited situation. And he is desperate, I think, to stop them from doing what they're doing. But I do feel he must back down on this question. In other words, I do not think this question is a scolding rebuke. I don't think so. That would be dangerous with a crowd like this, and it would be unnecessarily alienating for a crowd like this. These are the people he's come to win to Christ, not the people he's come to insult. So I think in a sense, he's probably asking it more like, why are you doing these things? And he answers his own question, right? We also are men with the same nature as you. Because remember, they thought the gods had come and stood among them. The gods have come down to us in the likeness of men, it says in 11. But he plays that back at them and says, we're men the same nature as you. Have we seen this before? In this series? Yeah, why stare at us, men of Israel? There's another place, though. What did Cornelius do when Peter showed up? Do you remember? He tried to worship him. Peter said, get up, I'm a man, I'm just like you. I'm just like you, there's nothing I'm doing special. So what then he says, just like this, very important thing, we preach to you that you should turn from these useless things. Does anybody have a different translation there? Useless, worthless things. How does he say this? Well, it's blunt. Actually, the word is like a vain things. Often is what you get. I mean, I'm thinking useless is probably better than worthless. Worthless, once again, sounds like he's spitting contempt at it, right? But do you think that's likely in this case? I mean, maybe I'm leading you a little bit on this. I don't think it says. But it just seems to me that if you're trying to win people, you don't necessarily approach them that way, where you just say, worthless, you know, stop, I'm a man, why are you doing these things? Okay, bud, you know, we'll leave you alone, you know, that kind of stuff. I just get the feeling like, why are you doing these things? I'm a man like you. These things are useless. They can't achieve their goal. Yeah, Mike. Yeah, well, we don't know. I mean, we are speculating as to what it's like as a speech and what the setting is, and I don't mean to read things into the scriptures, but it seems like to me I can't read this as a speech without somehow, on one level or another, I'm supplying this kind of information to the text. I mean, there's no way to read it with total neutrality there. Believe me, your mind and imagination are involved in your reading process, and they're painting this picture for you as you read a certain way. So I'm guessing, yes, surprised, yes, a little bit frantic, yes, a little bit desperate, but no, probably not spitting contempt and scolding. As a matter of fact, it seems to turn around a little bit, and he begins to make his case. And how does he begin to make his case? Why are you doing these things? They're useless, these useless things to the living God. And how does he make his case? Yeah, he starts with creation. How would he have started if it were a Jewish crowd? Yeah, or something, or Abraham. We said, I mean, with Stephen, Peter, in a couple of different places, they start somewhere in the Jewish story. This starts in creation. And we'll see that's the standard pattern when speaking to people who aren't from a Jewish background. They don't know Jewish scriptures, they don't know that history, they don't necessarily accept it, and so you start with creation. Now, all of those guys in the ancient world had some sense of which God may have created the world. Well, not all of them, but most of them did. But what's special about this God? Still in verse 15. He's living and he made it all. I mean, I think that would be strong. He's not a deity over one portion of the created order. He is the deity who made it all and is still alive. And then in verse 16, he makes an interesting point that would matter. Since this guy's a Jew, and he's obviously proclaiming this deity here, so what about this God in verse 16? How did he set it up here? Okay. Yeah, he allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. Think about that now with our God. Why did he do that? I mean, isn't he saying he hid himself? Does he say, well, if God's there, why doesn't he show up? You know, why doesn't he show himself? I mean, it's a great, great question everybody asks. God does hide himself a bit. Why in this case? Is it neglect and not caring in some bad sense?
Well,
Well, it does seem like if we'd say God is who we say he is, all-loving and all-powerful, that if he hid himself, he hid himself benevolently. He hid himself out of his love. Part of his relationship with the human race is to allow them certain kinds of development and work on their own. And he doesn't necessarily jump in there and make himself explicit. Partly because if God is all-powerful and does not hide himself, of course, then do you love him for the right reasons or believe in him for the right reasons, or are you overpowered by his presence and then have no choice? And I think one of the very basic things about human existence is he wants us to choose to love him. And that if he doesn't hide himself a bit, then that's no longer possible because we're overwhelmed by his presence and forced into this position, and it doesn't achieve faith. Only faith can do this. I mean, I think it's the only reason we say, you know, why doesn't God just make it irresistible? 2 + 2 = 4, and God is there. Well, why does God hide himself a little bit? Well, so we'll reach out for him, I think, is what the scriptures say. So we'll look for him. And so when we find him, we'll respond the right way and not out of improper motives. So he did leave himself. How did they know he was there, though? He appeals to them. How did they know he was there?
We avoid
by him hiding himself. Maybe not the word improper for me as so much as lesser. The fact that his presence would be overwhelming and uncertain and inevitable. We would no longer have any choice but to surrender to him because of his all-powerful, completely revealed nature. Whereas in this case where he hides himself, as I said, we must seek him and choose to love him. Choose to put our faith in him. I think the choice matters in there pretty strongly for me. Yeah, but they didn't know it.
No, but
yeah.
The outside world could see it.
They could if they had exposure to it. I mean, obviously, Jews, as you said, those God-fearers and proselytes were coming to synagogues and things like that and drawn to it. I don't think that was open to everybody. How do you know he was there, though? I mean, he says some things. He sent them rain. He sent them fruitful seasons. And what else did he do? It filled their hearts with joy and food. What's the food of the heart, by the way? Isn't that interesting? Filled your hearts with food. I'm a foodie, I can appreciate that. But what's the heart long for? Well, this is really interesting. He starts with creation. He accounts for God being a little bit hidden. I mean, we're once again speculating here. I think we have to draw this a little bit from other scriptures. But he has hid himself. But he has not left himself without witness. He sent rain. He sent seasons. And he's filled people's hearts with joy and with food. Well, and there, by the way, that's when it ends, right? That's it. The last line is filled your hearts with food and gladness. Yeah. Yeah, well, and lots of people make the connection between Acts 17 and Mars Hill and the book of Romans and the way the argument tracks out. I'm not inventing this word here. I mean, this is kind of standard stuff about the hiddenness of God. And I'm not meaning it absolute. I just mean, why doesn't God just, you know, drop down out of the sky and make it impossible to deny his existence? That's called the hiddenness of God. And I mean, all Orthodox theology accepts that God doesn't do that. And then they speculate as to why doesn't he do that? He could make it so easy. You know, I mean, he could just overwhelm us with an immediate sense of his presence. What?
He did with the Jews and it didn't work.
Well, yeah. Yeah, look at Rob's sermon. You know, he's right there. Doesn't seem to react to people. Anyway, I'm not, and we don't mean this in any absolute terms. As I said, but I'm not making this concept up. This is kind of real, just standard stuff. And it is that question, is why doesn't God just make it impossible not to believe in him? He can do that. Well, he apparently has a motive for that. You know, do we have a good sense of it, Jack? I don't know. You know, I mean, I'm just guessing. He really wants creatures who choose to love him for the right reasons, and apparently that can't be achieved by overpowering us with an irresistible sense of who he is. But he does reveal himself. He's revealed himself with the Jewish people. I mean, that's there. I mean, that's the developed line of God's revelation. But what's he done with the rest of the world? All the people in China and Japan and, you know, Arizona or wherever we are. Well, he's given them rain, seasons, and filled their hearts with joy and food. Going way back to the garden, right? They hid themselves. Yeah. It's clearly the other side of that, you know, another. He hides himself and we hide from him. And that's why the relationship's so messed up. What does this tell us, though? I mean, we'll look for an enduring lesson here for the church. But even at this, and we say this is probably a more elaborate speech that he's given, but even here he barely restrains them from doing what he doesn't want them to do. And we don't know how kind of it ends exactly in this situation. But what might this tell us about preaching the gospel or presenting God or talking about Christ? Think of the contrast with the sermon at the synagogue in Antioch of Pisidia, where you have a fine-tuned sense of sinfulness and the appeal of forgiveness and justification, and with the law, of course, was just such a kind of a no-brainer. He could take it for granted in his sermon, but here he doesn't even bring up the idea of guilt before God. He brings up the goodness of God as exhibited in giving people joy and food for their heart, which is always interesting. Well, I think a couple things need to be said here. First of all, that Christians can easily start the discussion as if the person they're talking to knows nothing about God. I think, but Paul didn't start there. He assumed they had an experience of God, they just didn't understand it very well. So that he starts with their knowledge of God, which is rooted in creation, and given very specific content through good things, through the positive rather than the negative. I'm thinking I've rarely ever heard an evangelist start there. An evangelist usually starts with, "You're miserable and you don't know it," isn't it? You know, trying to convince people they're really unhappy, they're wallowing in their sins, they're miserable. And I can speak from experience, it maybe you're not. I mean maybe you're kind of happy with that, and you don't sense a great sense of emptiness. I'm thinking, but Paul didn't start there. He started with God created all things. The sacrifices to Zeus are clearly vain. They won't get you there. But you do have this experience of the goodness of God. So not that you're unhappy and don't know it, but you are happy and you don't know why. It might change the way you present the gospel to people. You know, to assume that they already are experiencing some of God's goodness, and they just need to know more about that, than not that they are so thoroughly, I mean, obviously you get that view, they don't know anything about God, they don't care anything about God, and they're pretty miserable underneath it all. I don't know, I mean, that could be true of people, but at least Paul and this group here in Lystra, with their Lyconian tongue and their garlands and their oxen, that's not how he presents it, is it? It's actually 2:00 p.m. What? I've got 10 seconds. I want to use it. Who's got the last word here? My intention, of course, was to put this side by side with the speech to the synagogue and compare the two. So fill in the blanks, connect the dots, and we'll be back next week. We've got just, 2 or 3 more of these. Thanks.